Tune in to Fiwi Sinting with me, Hillary, every Thursday afternoon for your weekly dose of the Caribbean.
Citizen Carter, calling Network 23. Network 23, are you receiving me?
This is Network 23, not receiving. Intermittent loss.
Edison Carter to Network 23. Come on, guys, clear this link.
Network 23 to Edison Carter. The link is strong and clear. 2 minutes to airtime. Your controller is Garister.
Thank you, 23.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Carhill and me, Tony Gosling. Why is Julian Assange still imprisoned in the Ecuadorian embassy, even though there's no charges against him from Sweden anymore? And the Swedish authorities don't even want to interview him. No arrest warrant, nothing. It's just the Met. And getting away with it. 26 councillors in Devon are Freemasons, and there's no obligation on them to declare their membership, so there may well be many more. Why are so many more councillors and possibly MPs Freemasons than the rest of the population? Are they not there to work for us, but to do favours for their mates, like making sure they get planning permission, licences, that sort of thing? We have a look at Freemasonry in our present royal family, the Queen's strong but little-known connection to it, and go back to look at links to the Zionist movement, creating the State of Israel, as well as possible origins. They say it all started in 1717, but there's evidence from pre-revolutionary France that it actually began in the English Civil War. Finally, why did the outgoing chairman of the Police Federation use his final speech to attack Freemasonry within the law enforcement system and the police specifically? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can be sure to catch it online. This week, a full hearing from Grenfell Tower, Ground Zero. The locals are getting fed up with the lack of progress as the atrocity perpetrated on 70 people disappears from the headlines. But not on Dialect. That is Dialect at BCFM, noon next Tuesday. And I've got some shows for while we're away, as yet unaired due to technical troubles over the last few months. Download it from dialectradio.co.uk the week before broadcast. But let's start, Kevin, by having a look at some of the news stories from around the world this week. Particularly, this guy, Max Schrems, has brought a court case. Another one, actually over in Austria this time. He was famous for a while for suing Facebook successfully to get his private information back from them over in Ireland. But now he's moved his legal case over to Vienna, I believe.
Okay. The reason is dead simple. He had to bring his case in Ireland because the regulator, the EU regulator for Facebook, was in Ireland. Now, this little exercise to defend his Article 8 privacy right has cost Max 200 grand so far.
That's now, ridiculous.
This process is...
People can only challenge Facebook if they've got deep pockets, huh? Is that it?
No, this is... There's a hidden crisis. Max got a fantastic judgment in the Irish High Court. The Irish High Court found the American government guilty of mass and indiscriminate surveillance. Max won an astonishing judgment. Then he won the further judgment in the European, the highest court you can go to. But, and this is something I'm engaged in right now, neither of the judgments have been implemented by anyone. And we pay regulators and so on to implement, but Max has been left adrift by the
So what was the point of having that High Court in Ireland case if nothing's actually happened as a result?
Well, as I say, legally, it was a huge victory. And you will find nothing in any legal journal raising this judgment. This judgment is the first time, probably historically, that a High Court judge pointed the finger at the United States government and said, you're committing criminal offences in our country and in the European Union, and so on. And he documented it.
So they just shrugged their shoulders and say, so what?
Yeah, well, we've taken it further. Failing to implement the second victory that Max won in the European Court of Justice has not been implemented, and that is hugely serious, and not a single newspaper anywhere has written about it. When the judgments of the Supreme Court of Europe are ignored, then a central pillar of the EU itself is cracking.
Well, now, it certainly seems like that. But anyway, what's this? What's happened this week over in
Okay, this
Vienna?
Week, well, Max has done two things. He's launched a new website so that people can bring their own cases in their own countries. And he has started...
I guess we better put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, so you can follow what Max has been up to.
Yep. And Max is bringing a case himself in Vienna in the local court, which will cost him a fraction of what Ireland... I mean, he has wound up the defendant in Ireland. The regulator in Ireland made Max a defendant in his own case. I mean, it gets beyond the bizarre.
Also this week, we've heard that there is quite a serious cyber threat from Russia. The UK Defence Secretary, Gavin Williamson, has said that we've really got to watch out. And Sir Nick Carter, the head of the British Army, has also been saying that we aren't really able to fight a war with Russia because our 80,000 soldiers and the state of our defences are not really good enough.
Okay. This is the issue of fake news. We are back in what, at my age, I recognise as a complete Cold War propaganda war. What Williamson said is what we do to the Russians. He forgot to mention that. Nick Carter suggested we might be fighting Russia. We have 80,000 troops in uniform. The Russians have 1.1 million. With reserves of 2.5 million.
We're talking about NATO altogether, not just Britain.
No, but Nick Carter spoke specifically. This was the really odd thing. He spoke specifically of the UK fighting Russia. Well, those are the odds. And I don't think... Clearly, the whole purpose of NATO, in case there's war, is to be the first line of defence. But Carter spoke in terms of the UK fighting Russia. How could we do this? Two aircraft carriers with no planes and 11-1 basic superiority for Russia. But the fundamental thing is that this is a propaganda war. Most of the things, neither Williamson nor Carter has raised the issue of American spying in Britain. They're talking about hacking by Russia and all this stuff. Neither of them have said a word about the American hack in Britain that affects 38 million people.
Going back to look at cybersecurity and publishing, Julian Assange's health apparently is in a dangerous condition, say doctors. Two clinicians examined him with renewed calls for him to be given safe passage to hospital. It does seem like there's a punishment here going on because Assange effectively is one of the world's most important publishers of literature, whistleblowers, this sort of thing, that challenged the establishment.
There's no mystery at all. The Attorney General of the United States has said that arresting Assange and bringing him to the United States is a priority. And clearly, that priority is being helped by the British government. You know, they kept the Met outside the door. They won't. He's facing a charge of breaching bail, but that's not exactly a major criminal offence. And the government is, the British government is utterly mad, because if Julian comes out of the embassy and is snatched and the Americans are then allowed to bring charges, the United Kingdom will never be able to hold its head up again.
Now, a few things here. I mean, you know, every once in a while, surely, maybe not this time of year, but in the summer. In fact, why not even every Friday night? Assange could come out onto the balcony and give a kind of speech, couldn't he? And leak some of it. I'm sure people in London would love that. You know, they're going on, let's go and see Assange tonight. yeah. He could be giving some fascinating facts about what the Anglo-Zionist Empire is doing to the rest of the world. Yeah. He could be doing that. The other thing, of course, he could be doing is put on some sort of disguise and sneaking out of the embassy, pulling a fast one on the Met.
Haven't heard him that he has done that. He might have, but
no. But I'm suggesting. What I mean, why doesn't he at least, you know, and maybe even face the courts? Should he do that or not?
Well, I would suggest to him no. I mean, he's clearly being set up for a judicial kidnap by the British government on behalf of the American government. Now, the kidnap being arranged with the British government, by the American government. The American government is the same one that is spying in Britain and the British government's done nothing about it. The United States government commits crimes every day in this country using this spying program called PRISM. And when David Cameron tried to get President Obama to stop it, Obama refused.
But hang on, I mean, surely if you haven't done anything wrong, you've got nothing to worry about being put under surveillance.
This is stupid. The answer to that is simple. You have a right to privacy unless you are a suspect and there's material evidence against you. That's the laws, the oldest laws of England.
The old laws, okay, yeah, maybe medieval or something, but nowadays these intelligence services, I mean, we're talking about the signals intelligence people, GCHQ, the National Security Agency, they're all over the place. They're looking at various people's computers, maybe even switching them on and off while you're out, you know, this sort of thing.
No, it's much more specific, and GCHQ broadly are not allowed to do mass surveillance in Britain. The law has been tightened up and they have been forced into...
Well, they do what they get. They just get the Americans to do it. Sure.
Well, no, that there was the court case that was brought by Liberty and Amnesty saw the end of that. The High Court ruled...
But nobody knows what they're up to, Kevin, surely. Nobody knows whether they're doing this stuff. They're totally secret. No. They're intelligence services. They're not going to allow you or me to wander into GCHQ, have a look over somebody's shoulder and say, hang on, you shouldn't be doing that.
It's much... Well, you don't have to do that. The mass surveillance that's being conducted is fully documented in public in the Irish High Court. Why has no British reporter been over there to read the evidence? You could build the whole picture, but the largest amount of surveillance, and it does cover 67% of the population, is being done by the National Security Agency, not GCHQ.
Now, so Julian Assange is asked the UK courts today to drop his arrest warrant. Lawyers for Assange have asked the London court to withdraw this warrant for his arrest, saying it's lost its purpose. It was issued in 2012 after he allegedly breached bail conditions. Yeah. he's been facing extradition to Sweden. The Crown Prosecution Service says Mr. Assange could walk free if he succeeds. Before the start of court proceedings, Assange's lawyer, Gareth Pearce, told reporters the warrant should have no status because the proceedings in Sweden had come to an end. Earlier this month, the UK government refused to grant WikiLeaks founder any diplomatic status and called on him to leave the embassy and face justice.
The breaching bail is hardly a capital crime, but the real problem for Julian is a very simple one. The British government has set up a judicial kidnap. This is rendition by another name. The moment he comes out, an arrest warrant from the United States will turn up in the hands of the Met, who are probably already have it and who are colluding, and the Met need to think very carefully about this. Kidnapping somebody like Assange is a crime. If they're colluding with the United States to kidnap him and remove him to the United States, they are perverting the course of justice. And this is rendition by another name.
let's have a look at another cyber story. That's over in Afghanistan. I didn't realise it, but one of the wonderful changes that's taken place since the invasion of Afghanistan by NATO back in 2011 after the 9/11 attacks in the US is that they've now got these biometric identity cards over there. The long-standing effort to distribute electronic ID cards to citizens has been marred by a dispute in Afghanistan, leading to violent street protests and walkouts in parliaments and scuffles amongst politicians. The deadlock centres on the issue of whether ethnicity should be printed in the documents. So this is biometrics. This is things like DNA, iris scans, fingerprints, all contained within electronic, really within these ID cards. Now, this is the sort of thing that they were trying to do in Britain, and not necessarily exactly the same, but a similar ID card system. Mm. What are your thoughts about the move towards this? To me, it just seems totally unnecessary to have people's, identity in to such an extent put in some sort of ID card system, and particularly when you're talking about things like their ethnicity or their religion, this kind of thing.
None of this.
I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing which can be used to then single out people of a particular ethnic or religious bent for persecution by a secret police or whatever. It's like, I mean, the Gestapo would have loved this kind of thing. This is Gestapo-type technology.
This is Nazi technology. The position I take is the simplest one. There are old and solid British laws to stop this kind of thing, to stop the government having every iota on you. Unfortunately, right now, another government, the American government, is doing this every day, and the British government has done nothing. So you are worried about the British government getting the mass surveillance stuff from the American government. It's possible, and it may have happened, but it is illegal. And let me add to, we have an Investigatory Powers Act, which is in effect at the moment suspended. And the European Court ruled against it. It was Tom Watson brought the case. So the pressure from the United States to get us, the United Kingdom, to put the population under mass surveillance has failed. The European Court of Justice said you can't do it. Mass surveillance is always illegal, but the purpose of mass surveillance is control. It's a tool of power. It's not a tool of justice. And all this stuff should be publicly debated. But the intellectual response to the attempts at mass surveillance of our population are totally inadequate, and the legal responses as well.
Another cyber story. Russia is saying, and responding to the one we were talking about earlier, Russia is saying that Britain's Defence Secretary's claim of an attack threat is like something from Monty Python. This is in the Daily Telegraph a couple of hours ago. Okay. Russia has dismissed a warning by Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson that Moscow could cause thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths in Britain with an attack that would cripple the UK's infrastructure and energy supplies. In an interview with the Telegraph, Gavin Williamson said Russia has been researching the UK's critical national infrastructure, how it connects to continental power supplies, with a view to creating panic and chaos. Delivering his assessment of the threat from what he calls an increasingly assertive Kremlin, he said it was willing to take action that any other nation would see as completely unacceptable. Well, what do you make of the Russian reply to what Gavin Williamson is saying? Monty Python?
Not far off, because there's a fake news issue. What Williamson didn't disclose, or we're doing the same to Russia. We have had a surveillance program on all their overseas cables. We have got all their pipelines and everything else on maps, targeted. And Williamson is just, this is pure propaganda. And insofar as it gives you half the picture, but not the other half, what we're doing, it's false. And their response, well, they should, the laughing policeman, they should have turned on that record. The man is verging on the lunatic.
The Russia is ready to kill us by the thousands, apparently, Mr. Williams has said. Official representative of the Russian Defence Ministry, Major General Igor Konashenkov, accused the Defence Secretary of losing his understanding of where the limits of common sense lie long ago. Now, this is a war of words, Kevin, but what he's really talking about here is the idea that we could be disconnected from, as individuals around the country, and factories, hospitals, that kind of thing, from the electricity supply. And I assume he's talking about some sort of hacking here.
Well, given that the United Kingdom is the daily victim of a huge hack by the United States government, that's the one we should be worrying about. But the if your military service and you're in the kind of state we're in, we, the United Kingdom, have mapped everything in Russia. We've mapped all their cables, all their oil and everything. We have positioned ourselves to do the same.
The British government has spent, by the way, £11 billion in trying to persuade us to install smart meters around the country. The Times on 13th of January had a story, smart meters may be a dumb move. Smart meters and their challenges for energy distributors. It seems that the government has actually put £11 billion behind something which could allow the Russians to completely shut down our energy supplies.
No, what they've actually done is put $11 billion into something that the American internet companies can use to do mass surveillance. The effect you talk about is secondary. We've done the same to Russia. What's the difference?
The criticisms from CN News, New Brunswick, that's in Canada. This review about smart meters not being so smart is talking about the vulnerability of these smart meters. Why would they want us to install something which is so vulnerable that can, for example, allow, you know, what it does do is it allows the power company to switch your electricity off if you don't pay your bill. Remotely.
Yeah, that they're allowed to do without warning and all the rest of it, and there'll be all.
But the Russians can come in and use that technology too, and I imagine the other way around. But what I'm trying to get at here, Kevin, is why are we installing this innately vulnerable infrastructure?
Right. We were offered at home in our house. We were offered a smart meter, so I asked the company to put in writing a guarantee that the data being picked up by the smart meter would not be fed any further on to anyone. That was about 6 weeks ago. I'm still waiting, and we've never heard from them again. Yes, the danger is there. But the way Williamson is presenting it is Cold War propaganda. It's an unbalanced picture, and he doesn't tell anybody what we're doing.
Well, let's get back to the story about the army and potential problems with our armed forces being able to actually deal with the Russians. I suppose they're talking about maybe would they invade Scotland or somewhere like that? I don't know. But anyway, let's get back to Prime Minister's questions where this came up this week.
Andrew Bowie! Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, many members on both sides of the House, myself included, have expressed concern about the future of our national defences. But of course, the fact is that this government will always take the right long-term decisions to protect our national security. So can my right honourable friend today assure this House and assuage these concerns that this approach will continue?
Prime Minister!
My honourable friend has raised a very important subject. And in July, the government initiated the National Security Capability Review, which was in support of the ongoing implementation of the 2015 National Security Strategy and Strategic Defence and Security Review, to ensure that we do indeed have the capabilities, the investment in those capabilities that we need in our national security, and that that investment, those capabilities are as effective, as joined up as possible. I've agreed the high-level findings of this review with ministerial colleagues at the National Security Council, and I've directed that the work should be finalised and with a view to publishing a report on this in late spring. But it has been a significant piece of work. It will help to ensure we have the right capabilities. As part of that, we recognise more work was needed on defence to work on modernising defence. And we want to ensure that the defence budget is being spent intelligently and efficiently, and that we're investing in the capabilities we need to keep our nation safe. And my right honourable friend, the Defence Secretary, will update the House on this in due course.
Yeah. I mean, of course, the first duty of any government, Conservative or Labour, is to defend the country. And measures to make sure we are properly defended are reasonable. But the whole debate is being polluted by this revived Cold War rhetoric, which is one-sided. Our people, the British people, are only being told half the story. And that is dangerous and it's wrong.
So what's happened to journalism over the last 30, 40 years that means that we're really not getting balanced views? Or has it just always been like that?
No, I don't think it's a conspiracy or anything. There's a vast amount of information now around the place, and there are very few journalists. I mean, in London, there are maybe 700 staff journalists in media and so on, excluding BBC. But what you've got is 3,000 or 4,000 government press officers. It's extremely hard to report properly. There isn't the time. Not many reporters have the expertise to say, ah, Mr. Williamson, what about what we are doing to the Russians? We'd like to hear more about that from you. And are we provoking Russia? And who, you know, you ask the criminal question, cui bono, who benefits? And the party who benefits most from the raising of tensions with Russia are American arms suppliers.
What bothers me is that we've been talking for decades now about regime change, demonising leaders around the world. I mean, it really started in a really big way with Saddam Hussein at the time of the first Gulf War, because he wouldn't get out of the way. We wanted his oil, and so he was tricked by April Glasby to go into Kuwait. As she, the American ambassador, said, "Oh, we won't do anything. Just go and get that oil," you know. And of course, when they did, there was a big furore about it. And so you had Saddam. You've also had Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, a hate figure for whatever decades, actually did an amazing job with Libya, made it one of the best countries in Africa in terms of things like infant mortality, average wealth of the individuals there, the fact that they didn't owe anything to the IMF at all. They were completely 100% debt-free as a nation. And so Gaddafi was the bogeyman. Then we had Assad. Assad is now managing, it seems, to stay as the president of Syria. And I'm rather worried that what we're seeing now is, like you were talking about the Cold War, that there's actually a will to get regime change in Moscow, because that's the only place that that NATO and the Anglo-Zionist Empire can go now.
Well, the United States spends $73 billion on unexplained, you know, spy activities. Most of that is directed against Russia. And a great deal, the media are simply, you know, for the reasons I've explained rather than conspiracy, there are very few journalists and an enormous number of government press officers. And without a lot of expertise and, say, experience like I have of having gone through the Cold War and seen the demonizing of people by particularly the Tories and the right-wing American governments. It's just gameplay, and it's dangerous.
Isn't it sleight of hand as well? Because it's like, here's something to be concerned about and worry about abroad, where actually you've got people dying of cold on the streets outside your doorstep.
Yep.
Also, look, we've been talking a lot about cyber stuff, but I must mention this story because I found it absolutely riveting, although hardly any coverage in the national press. Intel's Spectre fixes. Spectre. This is James
Not
Bond.
Not a great choice of
James
name.
Bond. Well, I think it's to fix some sort of problem with a virus called Spectre. But anyway, Intel, who make these microchips for all we all use in our computers, we've got them in the studio here, no doubt, quite a few of them, fixes are complete and utter garbage, says the Linux inventor Linus Torvald. In fact, he uses some quite expletive language to talk about it. The Linux inventor Linus Torvald has never been one for diplomacy, they say, in The Verge magazine or online. He previously said various bad things that we can't say on air here for people not supporting Linux. And now Intel has angered him enough to generate some more expletives in a message to the Linux kernel mailing list at the weekend. Torvalds expressed his dismay at Intel's security updates to protect against the major Spectre variant 2 CPU vulnerability. Okay, Spectre is a vulnerability.
It's a vulnerability,
Of of processors. The industry has been scrambling to fix the meltdown, and Spectre vulnerabilities and the variant 2 of the Spectre has been particularly challenging. So this is where someone has discovered that actually you've hardwired into these chips ways that anyone can get under the radar through your antivirus, through your firewalls, and get straight into your directly into your microchip. But anyway, so some bright spark has discovered this, and what Intel have done is released a what they call a patch, where you install that and this is no longer vulnerable. They can't get in anymore. The only trouble is, once you install the patch, the computer either becomes totally unbootable, so you can't start it up, or else it just goes off for no apparent reason, switches itself off. Mm-hmm. So this is, I find it absolutely incredible that people working supposedly at this very high level in the high-tech world have invented a patch that actually destroys your computer. So it's almost like they're saying, well, you've got to have this vulnerability in your system, and if you don't have it, we're going to turn your computer off.
Yeah. Well, the original flaw was a design flaw in the chip itself. It's very profound, but it's quite like having a car with the back, one of the back wheels missing, but nobody noticed because the car stayed balanced on three. But the patches are hideous, and it's not clear they even work.
So it's almost like, okay, there's lots and lots of implications of this story, really, in that you've got all the sorts of upgrades that we're told to make on our computers. You're on your phone, you know, you're constantly being told you will upgrade this, you know, some sort of little Sieg Heiling message comes up there, you know, do this or else, you know.
Yep.
And you have to do these things effectively. Otherwise, you either keep getting bothered about it or else it does it while you're not noticing.
Correct.
So these upgrades actually could be downgrades. What you could be doing is turning, you know, actually handing your, by upgrading, begin inverted commas, handing your phone, your tablet, your laptop over to some either criminal hacker or else one of the signals intelligence services or intelligence people.
Well, you can be sure that the first people to take advantage of the flaw will have been the National Security Agency and people like GCHQ. But I would trust Torvalds. If he says the patches are dreadful, then they're probably worse. So, what can you say? You're told your car is missing a wheel and you're given a new wheel to fit on it. The only trouble is the wheel has no nuts.
Okay, so I got a laptop, well, it must have been a couple of years ago now, and when I got it, it came with Windows 10. I started using it for the first few days. It started just turning off.
Yep.
It would say, got to update me, whatever. And you couldn't actually switch it on for whatever, something like 2 or 3 hours. It would be sitting there going round and round and round. You can't switch the damn thing on. So I thought, well, I actually don't really want this operating system. Thank you very much, Bill Gates. And I managed to find a place that would, in fact, some of these small computer shops will do this for you, will actually put a much easier to use operating system on, like Windows 7 or Linux.
Linux
actually works reasonably well. I mean, you know, it's not as if it's impossible to use. And what it does do is it means that it's quite a lot of the applications that you might want to download software that doesn't work with it, but all of the main bits of software, for example Skype, things like that, that you know I use quite a lot, you can get just simple a Linux version of it. The other thing you can do, which many people don't realize, is you can put what I call an emulator on it, right? Okay, I've learned this word, where it actually behaves like Windows.
That's right.
So you can have a Linux at the bottom and you can have kind of Windows sitting on the top of it, and then you can install your Windows program on top of that.
Yeah.
Now, it just amazes me that how everybody, almost everybody out there, I'm sure most of the people listening, will probably have either Windows 8 or Windows 10 on their computer. But actually, both of these systems are it's almost like they are running your computer, not you.
Oh, no, that is, I mean, I've got Windows 10 and it was forced on my machine when I wasn't looking. I was thinking about what to do about it. And one day I switched on the machine and it was half done. No choice there. And the updates come, as you say, Sieg Heil, do that. You're not given a choice. And the updates are not explained. I mean, at a common sense level, you know, you're told, switch your machine off and don't do whatever. And these updates, and you're not told what the updates are.
I mean, they're treating us like kids. Although I suppose that, you know, the idea is that, well, this is all far too complicated for you to understand.
That's
so we'll just do it for you. Thank you very much, Bill. Also, I wanted to do something this week about Iran, because Iran is, I think, a fascinating country, completely misunderstood in many ways. Having visited it, what, 3 years ago or something now, found the people absolutely lovely, mostly very warm-hearted. And, of course, it's Persian culture. It's been going quite a while, a few thousand years, you know. Did things like Cyrus of Persia released the Jews from Babylonian captivity, which a lot of people forget, particularly Netanyahu seems to forget that one. And so I asked a guy who organises a conference there every year, which is happening in a few weeks' time, called the New Horizons Conference, where he invites creative people from all over the world. His name is Hamid Gashgavi, and I asked him, I said to him, look, what about women in Iran? Because the perception here in the West is that actually women are oppressed in Iran. This is what he had to tell me.
Take the example of a woman in Iran. 65% of students in Iranian universities are female. Can find the vice president, vice minister, the chancellor of universities. I mean, around the country, in the society, in private and governmental, companies, you can find women and female, I mean, everywhere. I mean, the society is much more feminist than some other European societies. But in the eyes of, you know, those ministry media in West, if we don't have that new slavery market, which is pornographic market, in Europe, in East of Europe, in West of Europe, in North of Europe. So because we don't have that, it means that we are against women, we are against so-called liberation of women, which is, I mean, Professor E. Michael Jones authored that book entitled Sexual Liberation and Political Control. In 400 pages, he explained how that, I mean, politically control is related to sexually liberate people. So if tomorrow Iran will say, okay, we are going to obey to those American government and we'll be like other puppets in the Middle East. So you will never, ever, never hear anything bad about Iran in Western media. And that's because actually they are looking for the interests. I mean, in Iraq and in Afghanistan, you see how that's American democracy by force. You know, they have invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, that war on terror after 9/11 they have started. So you see how actually they have been destroying people. I mean, that democracy and freedom by force, the French comedian Dieudonné has been saying that Americans arrive in Iraq, they ask people, they have a democracy? The people say, no, they don't have democracy. Okay, we'll put democracy by force in your mouth. Okay, you have to accept it. We would like to bring freedom and democracy. And you see the result after 10 years in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Sudan, in other countries. I mean, everywhere there is a chaos.
Yeah, this is. But how is it? It's done by working up a propaganda war in the West and demonizing. This is what he's talking about. Iran is totally misrepresented. Iran has an enormous, or Persia as it was, made an enormous contribution to science and mathematics, which are very important over the centuries. And this is all ignored.
What about this this week, the big scandal, the President's Club? We could have talked about that in the first hour, I suppose.
Wonderful.
But, you know, it makes me wonder. I mean, a lot of the girls who were getting involved in that knew what they were getting involved in. Effectively, there is an enormous prostitute market in London, which is going on all the time, and in fact all over the world, really. Not so, I don't know about in Iran. I think this they kind of stopped it over there, but this is normal in Bristol, in London. I mean, am I exaggerating to say that it was a bit of a moral panic about this event? I'm not saying it was right, but that prostitution and sexual exploitation is normal in many parts of London.
This is one of the problems. When it's normal at that level, you know, the Dorchester and the big charity and all the rest of it, it's wrong anyway. You know, if somebody wants to be a sex worker, fine. But people shouldn't be forced into it. And if they don't want to go along with it, they shouldn't be forced to.
Well, I mean, surely many of the people are trafficked into Britain to be sex workers. I know there was a story up in Hull recently where it was either the bishop or a canon up there was saying, well, actually, some of these caravan parks are just simply being used
by big brothels.
Well, it's effectively gangsters bringing people into women into the country and then using these caravan parks for as brothels.
No, I mean, there is a problem, but to go back to the problem with the Dorchester and the President's Club and the charity was that exploitation of a lot of those girls who went would have been poor. They'd have needed a few quid.
Well, there's another aspect to it.
A lot of them didn't volunteer to be pawed and groped.
No, and there's another aspect to it, and that is the completely stalled Alexis J. run VI paedophile national inquiry into sexual abuse of children. Now, here we're talking about accusations against senior conservatives, senior army officers, of actually murdering, and including intelligence people as well from MI6, intelligence people actually killing children to stop them testifying against them after having sexually abused them. It just seems to me that there's no interest in this inquiry anymore, and the whole thing has been kicked into the long grass. And yet we've got lots of stories of these kind of, you know, you put your hand on my knee, low-level sexual abuse, and that the really serious stuff, the serious criminal stuff, which people should go away if they're, you know, they should be going away for life for, you know, sexual abuse of children and murdering, is being forgotten about.
Well, it's been institutionalised. It's worse. There is the inquiry, but nobody's reporting it. Well, The Guardian does, but the point you're making is valid. But the thing about the Dorchester and the President's Club is it was low-level abuse at a very high level in society. In the people who should have been setting the agenda and making sure that paedophilia, which is a huge problem, is dealt with, were, you know, abusers themselves, because they got people behind closed doors. And I thought it was a wonderful piece of journalism. Sorry about that.
Well, it was, yeah. I mean, yeah. But I mean, what I'm saying is, I think, you know, you've got to have it at the same time, you've got to have it in the context of this much bigger and more important inquiry, which seems to have been, I mean, it was started by Theresa May, what was it, nearly 4 years ago now? And yet we seem to have got absolutely nowhere with it. And the woman who's in charge of it is really, it seems to me, only in her job, because when she was in Rotherham, she didn't find any. She's the fourth one. A bit like the Diana inquest, isn't it? No one actually wanted to do it, or they were kicked out if they were going to do it properly. So, you know, there are all sorts of, well, there's all sorts of problems with that particular inquiry. She made sure that none of the police, none of the social workers, etc. in Rotherham faced jail or whatever from the inquiry. And so it seems to me, because of that, that she's been put in charge of that.
She did. The Guardian interviewed her last week. She's providing no leadership. She should never have been given this job, but you've given the specific reasons why she shouldn't have had it.
Now, there's all sorts of, a couple of events that are going on next week. I should have really talked about this in the first hour. We were so enthused by Thangam that we didn't. One is called, this is next Saturday. It's after I'm away. It's on the 3rd of February, 7:30 at the Ark Bar, 27 Broad Street, BS1, 2HG. It's called The Lynching by Jackie Walker. To oppose Israel, she says, is not to be anti-Semitic. Well, Jackie Walker is a member of Momentum that was suspended from the party for saying that that Jews were involved in the slave trade, at the beginning of the slave trade. Now, she herself is Jewish.
Yeah, the particularly under picking up tutelage from the Americans, the current right-wing government in Israel, it's a standard tactic. You make any criticism of Israel and you're anti-Semitic. You know, there's no there's no way to make a choice.
I spoke to Jackie a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. It's on one of our dialects from a couple of weeks ago. So let's have a listen to a clip from that now.
Well, no, there's partisan reporting, isn't there? There's definitely partisan reporting. I remember
she's talking about
I had
on
an
Israel.
Interview once with the BBC reporter, and she said to me, off the record, of course, she said to me, off the record, I have to tell you what happened, is if we report anything about Israel and we do that in any kind of way, which is a negative, before that programme has finished, there will be hundreds of complaints, official complaints made against us. And so there's a barrage. You know, any media receive a barrage of criticism, all that has to be followed up. So I think in part there's that. And I also think it's just, you know, we are part of the American empire. The American empire has decided it's within their interest to back Israel and to condemn Iran. And we are party to that, and our media is also party to that.
Well, they're free to do that, aren't they?
Yes, they're free to do that, and we're free to point that out, or we should be free to have that pointed out without being accused of being racist.
Okay, Jackie, could you just tell us, give us one reason why we should come along and see your play?
Because you really enjoy it. It's actually, I mean, you know, Alexei Sale, who wrote a review in The Observer, said he initially came because he thought it was a duty, and he ended up just saying it was his choice for theatre for the Sunday Observer because he enjoyed it so much.
And it's on at the Palestine Museum on Broad Street on Saturday the 3rd of February at 7:30. And amazingly, if you come a little bit early, there's some food too. I imagine from the region at 6 p.m. they're doing food.
That's right. That's right. That's it.
Anyway, how do people follow your case online or in the newspapers, Jackie?
Well, they can have a look at my Facebook page, which is, I've got a couple of Facebook pages. One is called just Jackie Walker. The other one is called Jacqueline Walker. You know, and they are reasonably open. That makes it kind of difficult for me at times. But I'm pretty sure that when my case comes up in front of the Labour Party, as, for example, the Jewish Chronicle and the Board of Deputies have been sort of baying for me to be excluded from the Labour Party, I'm sure that it will be in newspapers and reported in the media.
Is there any kind of Jewish lobby in London that you would say is more balanced on Palestine and where you can get both sides?
Oh yeah, of course there is. You know, there's a Jewish Voice for Labour, for example. There's Free Speech on Israel, which is not a totally Jewish group, but has many Jews in it. There's Labour Against the Witch Hunt. These organisations are all organisations which are either significantly Jewish or, with in terms of Jewish Voice for Labour, they are actually totally Jewish. And then there's the Jewish socialist groups. There's Jews for Justice for Palestinians. There are many Jewish groups that see what's happening in Israel as something that needs to be challenged.
Now, this witch hunt, I mean, that's a fairly strong term to use. Would you see it as that as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, what a witch hunt means is that a series of smears are set up against people who are innocent and they are excluded and victimised. And that is certainly what's happened to me and a number of my comrades.
Well, when Who Owns the World came out, the Israeli ambassador wrote to me and said I should have the book pulped because I had said Tel Aviv was the capital of Israel. And he said, no, it wasn't. Jerusalem was. So he set himself up. I said, well, when the government of my country decides that Jerusalem is the capital, I'll follow my government.
And also, as promised, Steve Norman's funeral, just to announce where and when that's taking place. Of course, we had John Langley talking about Steve, and Steve was helping me with a report that I did back in November here on the radio. Steve Norman's funeral, he also worked very closely with the Bristolian paper, at South Bristol Crematorium, 9:30 on Friday, the 2nd of February. That's the day before the lynching is on. Followed by a wake at the Cabbage Patch Club, Lawrence Weston, BS 11OST.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Right, on to our little look at the Masons, Kevin. And I know you relish this because you've actually met a few Freemasons. I think you almost try and almost pretend to be one sometimes, don't you?
No, I don't. But one time I was in Zurich and I met the Grand Master and he showed me around the principal lodge in Zurich. In Zurich, there are 7 Freemason lodges. There's a Jewish lodge and a Catholic lodge and 5, you know, for piebalds. But I asked him, you know, what's the history of Freemasonry? And he said, oh, it was started in the 18th century. And I said, well, it doesn't look like that to me. And he said, well, actually, we are descended from the alchemists. And I quote you, he said, they had a bad press, so we don't like to raise the issue.
Who were the alchemists?
The alchemists were, in effect, the people who kept the idea of science going through the Dark Ages. They were trying to change lead into gold.
Did they get a bad press? How did they get a bad press?
Because they were reckoned to be magicians, and the Catholic Church didn't like competition.
Did they just not like science, the Catholic Church?
No, they didn't like competition.
Well, the main reason we're talking about the Freemasons, actually, although there is this brilliant report out from Devon about all the Masonic councillors down there, is that Steve White, who's stepping down as the chair of the Police Federation, says that the Freemasons are threatening progress of women and black minority ethnic people, and they're blocking reform in the police service. Reform in policing is being blocked by the Freemasons, and their influence in the service is thwarting the progress of women and people from black minority ethnic communities, the leader of rank and file officers has said. Steve White, who's stepped down in December after 3 years as chair of the Police Federation, he told The Guardian he was concerned about the continued influence of the Masons.
Yeah, I mean, it's a secret society. Despite pretensions to be open nowadays, it's to benefit its members first. And no civilized societies like ours should have groups belonging to a secret society involved in a very powerful and important things like parliament, like the police, like the military, but it's less so in the military.
There's been quite a lot in the press, at least in the Times, not elsewhere in the press, about the mafia in Italy joining Freemasons to do deals with the judiciary. Now, this sounds really pernicious. And also, just last week, Italy clamping down on the Masons after links with the mafia were exposed. So the Times is saying that strong links between Italy's secretive Freemasons and the Mafia have been exposed by police raids, with 193 crime bosses found to be members of lodges in Calabria and Sicily. Investigation confirmed long-standing accusations by magistrates and mob turncoats that Masonic lodges in southern Italy are venues for secret deals with corrupt judges, politicians and business owners. Now, one would have thought that any organisation that can allow that kind of thing would be, you'd have to register as a member of it if you were going to be a politician, but no. Anyway, I thought we'd look a little bit at some of the history of Freemasonry. For a start, there was two reports done by the Metropolitan Police into Freemasonry, Operation Tiberius and Project Riverside, in an article by Tom Harper in The Independent, revealing how gangs used Freemasons to corrupt police. So Freemasonry is used really as a vector to get inside, for example, CID offices, and effectively delete. It's one of the things that they say in the article. You turn up on a Monday morning and the stuff that you've done on the computer has just all been deleted. So the police investigations are thwarted that way. But officially, the Freemasons started in 1717. There's also, though, in the rituals, lots to do with the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple, which sounds bizarre. It almost seems to fit with the whole Zionist project, Kevin.
Well, the mythology of Freemasonry is firmly, it's absolutely centred on the Temple of Solomon and the first architect, Hiram Abiff. So how do you fill in the gap? What happened in between? All through history, there have been master masons at all the big building sites, churches, hospitals, and all that sort of stuff. And clearly they always got together. That's how they ran the trade.
Also, worth looking at some of the royal family. I mean, March 2013, the Queen was discovered to have a Masonic nurse. Even though apparently the Masonic hospital had been closed down in 1922, a photograph of the nurse who'd been nursing the Queen had a Masonic symbol and a witchcraft symbol belt from the Royal Masonic Hospital, even though it just wasn't supposed to exist anymore. That was in March 2013, so I'll put some links up to that on our show page. And also the nurse Jacintha Saldana she took a prank call impersonating the Queen, and she was suicided or committed suicide in December 2012, also at this so-called non-Masonic Edward VII Hospital. The Bilderberg conferences I look into, both Andrew Palmer, who was one of the organisers of a British conference, he was a senior PA to the Duke of Kent, the world's number one Freemason, and Joseph Rettinger, who was also a Mason, who founded the Bilderberg conferences, Edward VII, Edward VIII, the Nazi one, and George VI, who was a king during the war. They were all Freemasons. You can find pictures of them online with their cute little aprons on. Also, going back, Ataturk, who dissolved the Ottoman Empire in 1922, he was a Freemason, and I'll put some links to that as well on our show page, although the Turkish government don't like to admit it. Then you've got, going right back to 1648, because this is one of the things I discovered over Christmas, is that there's a French pamphlet by someone called the Abbé Laridan, who was saying that in order to assassinate or get the death warrant signed for Charles I, Oliver Cromwell formed Britain's first Masonic lodge back in 1648, because he knew that if he didn't manage to get this through, all through Parliament and voted through and get a death warrant signed for the King, that he would get the chop himself.
This was power politics. I think the Masonic, that story is interesting and I suspect may very well be true, but I think there were Masonic lodges in Britain long before that.
Could well be. Anyway, I'll put a picture of Oliver Cromwell between his twin pillars up on our show page. And some links to the history of the Masons. And this, I find, is incredible, is that nobody seems to make the link between Zionism and the Masons, because it's all the rituals are all to do with rebuilding Solomon's Temple, which, of course, the Zionist project is one of their key aims as well. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, MP for Bristol West, Thangam Debonair. Also to former Sunday Times Rich List journalist, author of Herons Britain, Kevin Carhill. Hopefully Martin will be back with Billy Quain an hour later, starting at 6 next week. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon. This show's story links and comment page, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM. I'll leave you with some music. No, we'll just go straight into the news. So do please join us for the politics show, starting at 6 p.m. from next week, in the capable hands of Billy. God bless. The 6 weeks while I'm away, and don't let the banksters get you down.
FM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.